House Committee on General Government to order. I'll get it spit out here eventually. And members, I'm going to, we're going to start with a work session on House Bill 2676. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2676. Patrick, would you give us a little rundown on what we've done with this, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We heard this bill on the 4th of March. The bill amends the legal description of the boundary between Polk and Yamhill counties in order to correct a longstanding error. I worked with Dan Lynchide, who was the Yamhill County surveyor, and they developed some technical fixes to the bill to so that the bill, as you see in the Dash 2 amendments, are basically a rewrite of the entire bill, because there were a number, about 28 changes that they made that more accurately reflect the landmarks that exist on the ground. And so the Dash 2 amendments are basically replace the original bill and correct all of the references to the landmarks on the ground. And they assure me this is as correct as can be.
Okay. So, with that, this bill is ready to go. It has no opposition as far as I know. Is there anyone here that wants to speak about it? Nope, there's not. That being the case, Representative Brzezinski?
I would move the Dash 2s as presented to the committee into the bill.
Thank you. Representative Brzezinski moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2676. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I'd move House Bill 2676 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Brzezinski moves House Bill 2676 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I'd just like, on behalf of Representative Shirley, who sponsored this bill along with me, I'd just like to thank the good administrators for working with my surveyor. And we now have, after 200 years or 159 years, we now have a boundary for Yamhill County and one for Polk County. Thank you very much.
You are welcome. Is there any other discussion? Gina, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Here. Aye. I don't know. You knew I was here.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Excuse. Aye. House Bill 2676 is amended, having received a constitutional majority. It's declared passed on to the floor. And Representative Nelson, would you like to carry this?
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Representative Nelson will carry this bill to the floor. And so I will close the work session on House Bill 2676. Thank you. What I'd like to do now, members, is move to an informational hearing. We have Metro with us, Doug Riggs, and he is going to just give us a little rundown. He has some prepared remarks with regards to Metro and what they do and what they don't do and all of that kind of good stuff. Is that correct? Am I correct in what you're going to cover, Mr. Riggs?
Zoo parking lot.
Zoo parking lot. Zoo. Some things just come back to haunt us all day.
Hopefully this will take less time than it took last session. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Doug Riggs with PacWest Communications, and I'm here today representing Metro. And I was asked by the chairman a month or two ago to come and give you an update on an issue that this committee considered last session, which took up a significant amount of time and debate. And we made a commitment at the end of the session after a bill passed the House and stalled in the Senate that we would take action on an issue, and I wanted to bring you up to date on what that was. I'm just going to read through the testimony. I want to make sure I cover all the points. As you may know, Metro is responsible for running a number of services in the Metro area, including solid waste, the convention center, the Expo Center, and the Oregon Zoo. We've had a tremendous run in the last few years with ever-increasing attendance. In fact, our attendance last year was almost over 1.3 million people. And this represents yet another increase. and we think it's a good sign of the benefits that we offer schools, children, families, grandparents, et cetera. I think the fact is that Oregon Zoo has become a destination resort of certain type for kids and schools, and you can certainly see that any day of the week from about the beginning of the second or third week of March all the way through September or October. I mean, it really is packed. We also have a number of partners up at the zoo on the property, including the Forest Discovery Center, the brand new Children's Museum, which has really been a tremendous addition to the area. There's a Holocaust Memorial up there, and there's also a Veterans Memorial. And combined, you can imagine it, they attract quite a crowd, especially on nice, warm, sunny days. We have a MAX stop up there, not Airport MAX, but a light rail station. And this is what prompted the issue that I'll get to in a second. But just as one of the questions that we received last session was how much we contribute to pay for the amortization of the debt that was incurred for the MAX stop. And the zoo pays almost $500,000 a year to help pay for the debt that was incurred by placing a station there. That stop does benefit the zoo. We've done studies that show about 17% of our visitors actually come by MAX. They tend not to be the visitors who have small children, because it's very difficult to get a stroller or a couple backpacks or three kids tagging along behind you onto the MAX stop. It tends to be older kids coming alone, volunteers coming to work at the zoo, or adults or grandparents who come with older children. The zoo parking lot is full on average of 163 days a year, and I wanted to pass out a few pictures for you to take a look at. Metro has a parking lot with slightly less than 800 spots in the parking lot. And if you consider the fact that we had 1.3 million people, you can imagine the number of cars it takes to deliver 1.3 million people, especially during peak periods of the year. And so that parking lot, as you can see from the pictures that are being passed around, in especially our peak periods from about 10 o'clock in the morning until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 6-7 days a week, especially on the weekends, on sunny days, is full. We've done very careful studies over the last year and have determined that our lot is full at some point during the day, approximately 163 times a year, so about half the year. And as a result, in the last few years, we've had to implement a shuttle program, which shuttles people from a number of remote lots up to the zoo. In the last year and a month, our shuttles transported almost 75,000 people to and from the zoo, people who came to the parking lot, found the parking lot full, and had to go elsewhere to catch one of the shuttles back. We believe that some percentage of the people who get to the parking lot and find it full just leave and don't come back, and that's unfortunate. We wish there were additional parking opportunities for them. And now we really get to what the crux of the issue was last year. The zoo is also a neighbor to other facilities that I mentioned, as well as a number of the residents in the area. And last session, a bill was introduced by Representative Jim Hill to turn a large portion of the parking lot, approximately one-fourth of the parking lot, into a park and ride for residents of the area up in the Southwest Hills. There were two main neighborhood groups, one of which supported the proposal, the other which opposed the proposal. We had a significant and lengthy debate during this committee's deliberations last session. It got fairly contentious at one point, and the bill ended up passing in the House and then stalled in the Senate. We came back and had discussions with the chairman after that occurred, and we agreed that we would pursue what we believed would be a common sense, limited kind of a pilot project to see if we could come up with a way to address the concerns during times of the year where the parking lot was not full. And so if you turn to the second page, at the top of the second page, I can go in brief detail about what we have done. And this was a fairly lengthy process because you have to remember that although Metro controls the zoo, we don't control the Children's Museum, the Forestry Center, the Holocaust Memorial, the Veterans Memorial, or the City of Portland, which owns the underlying parking lot. And so we had to get a variety of people in the room to discuss what would be feasible. We also had to come up with something that would pay for itself. The zoo operates on ticket receipts, gate receipts, and a property tax that was passed by the voters a number of years ago. And we do not have necessarily excess revenues to be able to subsidize parking for people who are not coming to our facilities. And so we went through a lengthy process of trying to determine what a fair market value would be, something that would be competitive. And what our zoo people did is take the cost, the average cost of full-time downtown parking, subtract the cost of a light rail pass for the month, and then take $10 off to kind of give it an added incentive. And so the number that we came up with was $95 a month. And we also, as we had discussed with members of the committee last year, wanted to try it in months where the parking lot typically is not full, which tend to be November, January, February, and March. And once spring break hits, especially in sunny years like we had last year, the parking lot tends to be full, during those peak periods, most of the day. You notice we took December off because Zoo Lights tends to attract people starting at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. People come early. And if you have the parking lot filled with park and riders, we do not have parking available for the people come to both Zoo Lights as well as other activities. We believe that we engaged in a good faith effort to get the word out to people. We emailed over 400 people. These were names of people that we got from the two community organizations. We actually mailed two people through the post office, almost 500 mailings. We provided information for neighborhood newsletters. We held a public forum, and we asked a number of the local newspapers, including the Oregonian and the Northwest Examiner, to run notifications of this. On top of that, what Sarah mentioned here is we extended the period for another month after the end of the initial period because no one had signed up, and we went out back to the email list again and tried to get people notified. And the result is here in the last bullet. Not a single person came forward to buy one of the passes. So we had really very little interest in this thing. Now, that does not mean that we're going to stop here. We have committed to evaluate the program, take a look at what we had proposed, see if it's reasonable. Work with our partners up there, discuss the cost, discuss various outreach proposals. We have no objection when the parking lot is not full to people using the lot for park and ride. It needs to be a system that we can monitor and that we can pay for the administrative costs of monitoring, and that's why there's a fee associated with this. But as we told the committee last year, we really do need to protect the parking lot during those key peak periods of the year for people who are up there with their kids, schools, et cetera. So bottom line is we appreciated the committee's interest last year. We have made a significant effort in the off-season to try to address this issue, and we will continue to do so. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Riggs?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Mr. Riggs, are you proposing do you have a bill to obtain funds from general fund for this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, we do not believe that the bill is necessary. We think that the free market in this case can function, and if people think it's a good value for them versus driving their car downtown and parking, that they would be willing to pay for it. We didn't have any takers this time, so we'll reevaluate a number of things, including the price, and there may be a way that we can bring the price down further, or that we can do it with a smaller number of spaces.
Any other questions? Mr. Riggs, did that parking cost, just out of curiosity, include the max pass also? So if they paid the $95, it included their pass onto the max?
Mr. Chairman, it did not include the price. What we did is we subtracted. We took, I think the baseline was $140 was the average price of parking downtown, and we subtracted what it would cost to pay for a max pass from that, and then we subtracted 10. So
gotcha.
If my numbers are correct, monthly max pass is about $30-$35 a month. And I can check on that just a minute.
Okay. No, that's fine. I was just, that's my fault for not hearing that. So, because it is written right in. Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions or comments? Okay. I just will, since you're sitting there, I'm going to ask you one real quick question on another matter, and that is a couple of weeks ago we had the taxi issue come before us. You were going to work with the city of Portland in convening a work group that was going to include the folks from the industry as well as folks from TriMet and Smart and some others, and I was just wondering how the process, since we're at about 2 weeks out, how's the process on that going?
You can hand something out here. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity.
I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No. I was prepared for it and anticipating this. Mr. Chairman, you're exactly right. We have the bill in question was the bill introduced by Senator Ringo, which would transfer the entire taxi system to Metro, and testimony heard during the hearing 2 weeks ago indicated that it might also be good to include some other for-hire types of transportation in kind of a package that would be transferred to Metro. I will say that there's been quite a discussion inside the Metro building regarding this particular bill. This is not an inconsequential matter for Metro to assume. I mean, this is a very large, very complicated, and very, as you saw, complex and controversial at times type of issue to run. And so what we have done, we had a number of people in the Metro office back in Portland meet with their counterparts at the City of Portland. They've had discussions with a number of the for-hire transportation people. Most of the discussion and debate has taken place in Portland since that's where the experts are. And what Metro wanted to do is, number one, decide if assuming the responsibility for taxis made sense within their framework, and I indicated to you that I thought that they would, and they've decided that although it's a large task, we're willing to do so. It fits with our kind of regional approach. And so what we've done is we've put together a number of talking points here that we are suggesting be incorporated into an amendment that would be in Senator Ringo's bill. And I've handed out copies to the entities that you mentioned. We're hoping to be able to sit down with them in the next couple of days to make sure they're okay with it. We've had informal discussions with our principals back in Portland, and we hope to be able to go to Ledge Council and bring you an amendment within the next week or so that would be able to allow you to move the bill.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. And you've talked with Senator Ringo about that as well?
I have not talked to him directly. I've dropped off a copy of this amendment and have not yet heard back from him.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, members, I'm going to... do we still have a quorum?
Yeah, we're ready.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2913, and Representative Williams is here. Representative Wilson, nice to see you again.
His radio voice has changed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee, for allowing me to come before you this morning to testify in support of House Bill 2913. For the record, my name is Representative Max Williams. I represent House District 35, which is Tigard in portions of East Washington County and some portions of Southwest Multnomah County. I'm here today, in fact, to testify in favor of House Bill 2913. This is an issue, obviously, as you're aware, that relates to the 911 tax. And House Bill 2913, I believe, would put the state on the course of doing what's necessary to make this tax function in an appropriate and fair manner among those counties where it's currently collected and distributed. Since 1981, the year the legislation was originally adopted, local governments in Oregon have reduced the number of primary and secondary communication centers from 293 to less than 70. Currently, there are 54 primary public safety answering points in Oregon. In 1991, you may be aware that Oregon became the sixth state in the nation to provide border-to-border 911 services. Current formula under this current provision distributes the 911 tax in a manner that is disproportional to the workload. Original legislation distributed the entire tax to local governments, whom were charged with building, maintaining, and operating the 911 system. The system has been built and is now maintained by a separate 35% allocation from the entire tax. House Bill 2913 proposes a fair, equitable solution to provide the much-needed resources to our 911 centers across the state. The bill proposes changing only the portion of the tax, that 58%, that is distributed to our 911 centers to offset operating expenses. The statute restricts the use of the telephone tax to costs related to answering incoming emergency calls and dispatching emergency services. And you may be aware that the Secretary of State audit conducted this past year identified that certain counties have been collecting annually more than 300% of the cost of contracting for 911 services. This is disproportional to the 20% average enjoyed by most of the centers of our state. Recognizing that the direct correlation between the population and workload of the 911 centers tied to this tax is what motivates me to be in support of this bill. This proposal would recognize that workload adjustment and would treat those counties and those places where they are operating that PSAP and handling the majority of the calls in a much fairer manner and really meet what I believe was the fundamental purposes of the tax in the first place, which was to fund the system in a manner that would actually function for all Oregonians. So I would encourage strongly the committee's support of House Bill 2913. You'll hear from some people who know a lot more about this than I do here in the next few minutes, and I think they'll be able to answer the technical questions about both how the centers operate and how the taxes are actually used that are collected for these individual centers. And I just encourage the committee to have a full and fair hearing on this issue, but remembering that the purpose of this bill is not to take from some and give to others, but to really balance the system out in a fair manner that treats all Oregonians fairly and that truly does balance the supporting needs of our 911 operational centers around the state. With that, Mr. Chairman of committee, I'd be happy to answer any of the questions that you think I might actually have an answer to.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Representative Mabry?
I have a couple questions, if I may. Sure. One being, is it not statutory that each county provide round-the-clock, 24-hour, 7-day-a-week emergency 911 answering point for those emergencies that are called in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, I think that may in fact be required. And I think the point of this bill is that there are some counties, inappropriately so, where it doesn't make sense to have a separate call center. And so they have either contracted or created agreements with neighboring counties to develop cooperative call centers, which seems to me to be an appropriate response. It's not an issue of ensuring that everybody has the sufficient support that they need to support their regional or their own county call center. It's about making sure that this is balanced in such a way that the centers that are handling the bulk of the calls are also receiving the appropriate level of support.
Follow-up? Would you, to be able to provide that service, you would need a dedicated telephone line, however, no matter where the answering call is?
Representative Crummell, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, that may be true. And from a technical standpoint, I couldn't answer that question for you on how that technically works. I would assume that there must be some sort of a dedicated line.
I assume then you would also not be able to tell me how Wheeler County could provide a dedicated telephone line to anywhere for $1,804 a year, much less someone to answer that phone at the other end.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, I could not tell you anything about the functioning of Wheeler County.
Thank you.
Not only about 911 issues, but just about everything else in Wheeler County.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Williams, I don't know, I hate to hit you with this, but apparently we don't have enough financial data here to see the irregularity of the distribution at the current time. I mean, for example, in my county, one city has a system, another system, another city now has to upgrade its system because they were unable to meld it into one countywide system because of something beyond my comprehension. So is the issue here that the counties are not getting equitable number of dollars per user?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I think the issue is that the way the tax currently is distributed, that there is an inequity in the distribution of when one factors in the amount of population being served and the needs of the broader needs of the system. I think that's the issue. But I'd leave it to those who are going to testify after me, Representative Nelson, to explain to you the details of the financial breakdown among the counties, because I think it can be confusing, and I think that they're going to be in a better position to explain how that works.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Williams? Representative Williams, you mentioned the Secretary of State's audit. Do you know by any chance, and if you don't, that's okay. I can defer the question to someone else. But you mentioned that there was some counties that were receiving up to 300% more than what was required by whatever contract they had in place and that sort of thing.
That is my understanding of the results of the audit, Representative Cronin, and a number of other issues.
And so 2913 then really would fix that. By reappropriating it, then it would actually take care of that 300% overage?
Yeah, Representative Crummell, I don't think that the desire on this approach is, and I think what you'll hear the other proponents of the bill explain to you in the committee, Mr. Chair, is that this is really about an equalization approach or a phased-in approach that would hold some counties harmless while and keep them at the same rate. But allow the other counties that are being disproportionately affected to, over time, step up. And I think you're going to hear some implementation strategies that may be needed in amendments to the bill talked about in front of the committee today. But I think the intent, again, is to recognize that there is a disproportional distribution of the funds when one factors in both population and use of the system, and the issue in this bill is not to undercut the one half of that, the maintenance side, which is that 35%, but it's to focus on the 58% of the tax amount, and to see that there's some changes in the way that that's distributed on a more equitable basis. That's again the intent of the bill.
Okay.
And the mechanics, again, are something that I would leave to others to talk to you about, and obviously the committee's judgment and how best to address the issue in the long term.
Okay. Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. Okay. I'm going to call folks up in panels based on their position on the bill. So what I would like to do is start off with Sam Hamilton, Dave Austin, and Jeff Johnson. And so if the three of you would just go ahead and come forward and and why don't we start actually in the order that I called your name. So Sam, if you would start for us, please, and then we'll go from there.
Certainly. Chair Crummell, members of the committee, my name is Sam Hamilton. I'm Executive Director of the Klamath County Emergency Communications District, located in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Excuse me. I'm here on behalf of the District Board of Directors to speak in favor of House Bill 2913. House Bill 2913 does two things relating to the distribution of the telephone tax as it goes out to cities and counties and further to their 911 jurisdictions. First, it corrects inequities that have existed for a long time by returning back to the allocation methodology that was originally implemented in 1982. Second, it addresses a problem that was recently described in an audit by the Secretary of State, whereby certain entities are receiving far more telephone tax money than their cost of providing the 911 service. And if you don't mind, I've got a couple of overheads that I think might help show some of these factors.
Do you know how to turn that on? Does anybody know how to turn on the... I'm not the technical whiz here, so...
That's nice equipment. Nobody knows how to run.
just have to work through some of this.
Oh, hey, there's light.
He's good.
Woo-hoo.
This button said on.
That usually helps. Can you dim the lights for us a little bit, Gina? Maybe?
We've got a copy of that, I think, in our handout.
We do.
So in your testimony that you gave us...
You have Sam. These, and I think that'd probably be better seeing the results there. Attachment 1... is a copy of a report that accompanied the very first distribution of the telephone tax to cities and counties. And the information on this report identifies each city, the city's population, and the amount of money that they received. It also identifies each county, the county's unincorporated population, and the amount of money that that county received. At the bottom of the report is an interesting note that reads, the calculation for the counties of Gillum, Sherman, Wheeler, and their cities is based on $2,126.94, which is 0.2% of the total. The original legislation in dealing with the distribution indicated that cities would receive their distribution based on their population per capita. Counties would receive a distribution based on the unincorporated area. It went on to state that each county, however, would receive a minimum of 0.2% of the total statewide distribution. The purpose of that minimum was to recognize that very small counties had certain fixed costs to provide the service, no matter how small they were. And so there should be a minimum, and I would liken that perhaps to the state school funding, where there is the small school fund that provides a supplement for the very small school districts, kind of the same principle. Again, if we look at this distribution, however, we see that the 0.2% minimum was the total amount that went to those minimum counties, including their cities. And I boxed in for you, for an example, the county of Wheeler, which was one of those three counties receiving the minimum. If you add up the amounts distributed to each of the cities and to the county, it totals $2,126.94. So that was the sum total that went. So the cities and the county each received the identical per capita amounts in that case. Subsequent distributions continued in like manner until December of 1983, and I would refer you to Attachment 2, which is the report that came along with those disbursements. And at that point, you'll see a rather dramatic change occur. Now the calculation for counties, and it gives the number for each county, county 1, 11, 12, 13, 19, 25, 28, 32, 35, is based on $3,454.63, which is 0.2% of the total distribution. What is different in this, however, if you again look to the example of Wheeler, now the county is receiving that entire minimum amount. The cities are receiving a separate per capita amount above and beyond that minimum. It's interesting to note that this change took place not due to legislative action. The law remained identical. No changes were made to the law. I spoke to the gentleman that was in charge of these distributions at that time for the Office of Emergency Management, and he just couldn't recall what precipitated that change. So that's a little bit of a mystery, but it is very significant in our mind. Since then, several other changes have been made to the distribution. In 1987, the minimum allocation was increased from 0.2% to 0.6%. Then again, in 1995, the legislature increased the minimum, this time to a full 1%, which is where we are today. The combined effect of increasing that minimum amount, changing the calculation, has increased now the number of counties eligible for that minimum distribution from the original three to now we have 28 of our 36 counties now receive that minimum. And again, if we go back to the principle of minimum, it was to help the very small counties that had certain unavoidable fixed costs to provide the service. And it's certainly gone far beyond that in our estimation. Exhibit A in the written testimony is a spreadsheet. And what that does is take the same data that you saw in those attachments as far as the distribution, but it also adds the per capita amount. That's important to see because the information that accompanies the distributions only shows population and the dollars received. So with Exhibit A, you'll see each county, each city, the per capita amounts, and more importantly, we've totaled for each county the total of dollars going into that county, the total population of the cities, and the unincorporated county population. And you see then a aggregate or a total per capita for each county.
Mm-hmm. Well, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
On page 7, where Wheeler County is listed, mm-hmm. I mean, is there not something wrong with this 56 under per capita of Wheeler County? I don't understand that. Where it has 56-something dollars and 43-something.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, if you look at others that are in the 700, you know, that's a one-point-something number.
Right.
And there it's a 56 number. What is that?
Chair Crummell, Representative Nelson, that $56 and 17 some odd cents. That is the per capita amount of the distribution for Wheeler County government, not the cities there, but for the county. And that is arrived by taking the population, unincorporated population of Wheeler County of 770 people, and the dollars received, which is the minimum 1% distribution. In this case, that equates to $43,258. So Wheeler County being one of the minimum counties, you can see, I think, with this, the rationale of the minimum. A very small county, very small population-wise, having certain fixed costs, they receive that minimum 1%. So their per capita is quite large.
Very.
Yes. Yes. Also on this Exhibit A, the left-hand set of figures would represent an average quarterly distribution for the current biennium that we're in now. And then for comparison purposes, we've added on the right set of columns that would show for the same total dollars what the distributions would look like under House Bill 2913.
And these are quarterly distributions?
Quarterly distributions.
Okay.
Exhibit B is a graphical representation of that data gleaning the county totals. So if you go to Wheeler, on the spreadsheet and look at the total population of the cities and the unincorporated, the total dollars received and the per capita amount, that is displayed then graphically in Exhibit B. Again, looking at the average quarterly distribution for the current biennium. The counties are ordered from left to right, from smallest to largest in population. And the trend line that you see traversing that graph is the population with the scale on the right. When one looks at this, then you can start to see the inequities. as you follow these vertical bars showing the per capita amounts and the counties ordered in population, anywhere that you see a county bracketed on either side by a county with a higher vertical bar, that suggests there's not an equitable distribution going on. And I think that can best be highlighted by taking two counties from this and looking at them side by side. And for purposes of that, we've chosen Josephine County and Benton County. And that is shown in Exhibit C in a side-by-side comparison for you. Both counties are real similar in total population. Josephine County is a little over 3,000 larger than Benton County. Both counties are served by one answering point doing the same function. One would expect then counties of similar size to be receiving similar telephone tax dollars to support their operation. And what you see is just the opposite. In this case, if you look at the total received, Benton County is receiving $98,847 a quarter. Josephine County, the larger county, is receiving $77,387, a significant amount less. And that can all be pinned down if you look not at the city amounts. You'll notice each city is receiving identical per capita amounts for both counties. It's the amount going to the county government in both of those counties. Benton County, with a small unincorporated population of 18,532, is eligible to receive that 1% minimum. Again, $43,258. Josephine County's unincorporated population, being much larger, makes them ineligible to receive that minimum. And that is the difference, then, in the distribution, and what highlights the inequity for those two counties, is that minimum distribution being based on the unincorporated population only, not the total county population. At the bottom of that sheet, we have, again, a side-by-side comparison of the same two counties with the same overall dollars, but how it would look under House Bill 2913. Now what we see is Josephine County, with a 4% higher population than Benton County, receiving 4% more tax dollars, and incidentally, Josephine County has 4% higher call volume of 911 calls. And I think that is really the issue here. Population is what drives 911 call volume, and it is the 911 call volume that drives our cost of providing the service. The greater the population, the greater the number of calls, the higher the staffing you must have. And so we feel House Bill 2913 corrects that inequity that is evident there. And if you were to go back again to Exhibit B in that bar chart, looking for those situations where from county to county you see some pretty wild increases and decreases in the per capita, you will find those inequities exist throughout and to some pretty high extents.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Bakken.
Going back to your Exhibit C on that, the lower distributions under 2913, if instead of Benton County you had included Gillian, Polk, Sherman, or Wheeler and compared it to Josephine, then you'd be comparing, as I understand the bill, a total of zero to Josephine County's 1.164. Is that right?
Chair Crummell, Representative Avakian, no. House Bill 2913 does not zero out distributions to Wheeler, Sherman, and Gillum counties. It makes them not eligible for that 1% minimum.
What would they receive then?
They would just receive the residual, if you may look at it in that term, the residual per capita amounts And that is the amount that you would see if you move up on that Exhibit C, the amounts that go to the cities. They receive what is left over after all those minimums get applied. Then the remaining population of the cities and the counties that don't receive the minimum is divvied into that remaining money, and that's what's left over. So they would receive the residual per capita amounts, the same as all the cities currently receive.
And it's your position that even with their fixed costs, that's enough for them to adequately provide for their communities?
Chair Krimmel, Representative Avakian, we're certainly open to looking at that. This, I think, is a starting point. The audit report that was earlier referred to, and I also have in my written testimony, suggests that those three counties have, over the years, collected a rather significant amount of excess money. We don't know how much that is. I'm sure that those figures are available somewhere. Our thought is that they would be able to operate off of the reserves that they have now for quite some time. At that point, I think it would be logical to consider perhaps a second tier minimum amount instead of a full 1% for counties that don't operate a public safety answering point, a lesser amount, I think, would be certainly worth looking at. The last graphical type representation I would like to have you look at, and I think it, at least in my mind, maybe brings home just how nebulous the current formula is, that it's seemingly a very arbitrary type of distribution. And I apologize for not having labeled this as either an attachment or an exhibit, but it should be the very last page in your handouts. Just recently, in fact, over the weekend, there was a rather large article in the Klamath Falls Herald News where there's renewed interest again in the possibility of the city of Klamath Falls annexing a suburban area that immediately is adjacent to it. This was tried some years ago, and it was narrowly defeated at the ballot box. The estimates indicate and suggest that that annexation, if it occurred, would add 20,000 people to the population of the city of Klamath Falls. What that would then do is reduce the Klamath County unincorporated population by 20,000 as well. And I thought that's kind of an interesting concept in light of this discussion. And what you will see is, again, the current distribution, in this case for Klamath County, under the current formula. And there's a total amount going into Klamath County of $65,828 per quarter. Simply by that annexation, should it occur, our fortunes would overnight change dramatically, and we would be receiving $86,179. And again, why? Because of the unincorporated population. It's a basis for this current formula, and we don't believe it should be. If we go back again to the very first distributions that were made, that wasn't the basis for that minimum distribution. It was looking at the total county population, and that minimum was the total amount that went into those counties, including their cities. We would certainly, I guess, welcome being the recipient of such a bonanza, but I can tell you that that annexation would have no bearing on the cost that I have of providing 911 service. Our call volume would not go up. We're still serving the same people. It's just a different mix now between those people being in the city or in the county. To me, and this could happen anywhere in the state. You could get these kind of situations that would seem to have no bearing on 911 and the cost of providing the service, but could dramatically affect the distributions that go out. Kind of summarizing this portion of my testimony, we view this very similar in nature, again, to the state school funding and the principle that is applied there. there's a statement that summarizes the equity principle applied to state school funding for K through 12. It's found in the Department of Education's biennial budget document, and you have attachment 3 shows that to you, but I'll read it. In short, every school district should get the same amount per student, adjusted only for unavoidable differences in costs. Rather than students, we're looking at population. Students drive the cost of education. Population drives the cost of providing 911 services. And again, the 1% minimum could be likened to the small school fund that recognizes that the very small school districts have some costs, fixed costs, that are unavoidable, that need to be attended to. I believe, go much into the second element of House Bill 2913. It was already discussed in a little bit here. It's in response to the audit that was recently conducted, and you have that audit report in my written testimony. It suggests that those three counties that do not contain an answering point but contract out for it have been receiving a substantial amount of money in excess of what their costs are. We believe that that money, that state tax money, should be out there serving across the state in an equitable manner, and it would be a better use of that money. I appreciate the discussion and concern for those three counties. We share that. We'd certainly not want to harm their ability to provide the service at all, and we'd certainly be willing to consider, again, maybe a second tier of that minimum distribution.
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to hold questions and let the rest of the panel go ahead and testify. Mr. Austin, why don't you go ahead?
Chairman Crummell, members of the committee, my name is Dave Austin. I'm the director of Washington County Consolidated Communications Agency. I'm here before you today representing the governing board of our agency to testify in support of House Bill 2913. Current statute restricts the use of the telephone tax to costs related to answering incoming emergency calls and dispatching emergency services. The audit conducted by the Secretary of State this past year identified distribution to certain entities that dramatically exceeded their related costs for providing this valuable service. In fact, some entities collected over 300% of their annual costs for 911 and dispatch services. In contrast, the telephone tax collected by local government typically provides approximately 20% of the operating expense for 911 centers in Oregon. The distribution of the telephone tax is a divisive issue. You will, I'm sure, be presented with information through this dialogue that this change threatens the viability of our 911 system. To the contrary, this bill maintains the integrity of our network and proposes to change only the distribution of the portion of the tax distributed to local governments. It's currently approximately 58%. That tax is intended to operate our 911 centers. Further, it continues a minimum distribution to those counties continuing to operate 911 call centers, enabling adequate staffing for answering calls and dispatching emergency services. House Bill 2913 provides a fair and equitable fix to an outdated and faulty distribution formula. It directs the available resources to our 911 centers based on a reliable determinant for workload, total county population. There is agreement throughout the public safety community and of the direct correlation between population served by a 911 center and the number of incoming emergency calls or dispatching of emergency services. The Oregon chapter of the Association of Public Safety Communication Officials sponsored a committee to study this very important issue. You may hear testimony today recommending an implementation strategy for House Bill 2913, which would financially hold harmless certain agencies that currently operate 911 centers. Washington County participated in this effort and is supportive of such a solution so long as the intent of House Bill 2913 is achieved in reasonable time. Chairman Crummell and members of the committee, it's an honor to present this testimony today. The solution represented by House Bill 2913 is fair and equitable to entities that operate 911 call centers in our state. We respectfully urge your support.
Okay. Thank you. Chief, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, Chair Crummell. Chair Crummell, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Johnson. I'm the fire chief for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, Oregon's largest fire district, serving about 400,000 people in Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah County. Our fire district is a very diverse fire district in that we currently serve 10 cities and portions of the three counties we mentioned. So the policy issues get rather convoluted from time to time, as do many things that this committee faces. However, it's easy to come down on House Bill 2913. We are served primarily by Washington County Consolidated Communications Agency, which we call WACA. And it is a fully consolidated center serving all 20 public safety agencies in Washington County. And I know consolidation has been a goal of the legislature for quite some time in Oregon. I'm happy to report that in Washington County we've achieved that. This center, WACA, handles approximately 500,000 public safety incidents per year. And House Bill 2913 will have a profound impact on our 911 center. It, as mentioned in prior testimony, reallocates the currently authorized funds in what I would term a more equitable fashion. Under the current formula, WACA receives approximately 20% of its total annual operating costs from 911 tax, and the remaining 80% is made up by local jurisdictions. While, as you've heard before, other counties are not receiving 20% of their operating costs, or 50%, or even 100%. In some cases, it's 300%. And as I look at what House Bill 2913 does, one of the things that it could do for us is take that overage and place it back in the pool so that other entities can use that to support their operation. While I am certain that I would oppose this bill, if WACA was receiving 100% or more of its operating costs from 911 funding, that isn't the case. And because there are those aberrancies in the statutory allocation, that puts us in a position of literally saying, is there a better way to allocate this money, given the fact that money's tied all over, and when money gets tight, we start looking for solutions and for new ways of doing government. In fact, the formula used today distributes 911 tax in an illogical fashion. While it uses a clear methodology, the formula is flawed. 911 tax money is critical to all Oregon counties, and frankly, Oregon can't afford to reduce the pool of money available. But how it's allocated could use some science, and I believe that House Bill 2913 provides that science. And while I anticipate that some well-respected public safety officials will oppose 2913 due to a loss of revenue, I think that few could argue that the application of science to this formula is a needed and welcome breath of fresh air. And I would also intimate that I believe that no one wants to see anybody's formula for how they provide or how they receive 911 money to decimate their ability to provide 911 service. I think that, as testimony has indicated, they are open to adjustments that would protect those entities. Conversely, percentages that are in excess of what you require to operate your 911 center seem to be an aberrancy on the other side that requires some attention. So with that, I would like to submit this group to questions, should the committee have any, Chair Crummell.
Okay. Thank you. There are questions for any of our panel members? Representative Nelson?
Well, I'm sure, Mr. Chair, that I need to study this, but I'm just curious, you know, if you look on page 6 of this information, Mr. Harrison, or Hamilton, that you gave us. When you look, for example, at Wallowa County, where you're getting $5.97 per person, on page 6, you with me? Okay, I mean, comparable to what, you know, schools do, I mean, shouldn't everybody be, should not a legitimate cost of a system be equivalent to this $1.16? I mean, I don't know what a system costs, but is the reason those are so much higher because they bought a more expensive system and are operating it inefficiently? Because I understood from the staff that it's supposed to be based on the cost.
Chair Crummell, excuse me, Representative Nelson, again, in the case your example that you're looking at, Wallowa County, their total county population is only 7,250 people. So they're one of those very small counties. Again, if we kind of take a likeness of the 1% minimum being guaranteed to each county, similar to the small school fund and state school funding, that's the likeness. There are certain fixed costs that Wallowa County has in operating a public safety answering point. The staffing level to answer a few calls requires a minimum. And so the 1% recognizes that, and we do not argue with the 1%. We think that that is a valid concept, but we think it needs to be applied based on total county population. In this case, a very small county certainly should be eligible to receive it. They've got certain fixed costs that they have to meet. And so their per capita certainly is much higher than other counties. But the overriding thing that we're after is that counties of similar size and population should have similar distributions, and currently that just does not happen.
Well,
do you have a follow-up?
Yes, sir. I guess what I was trying to say, for example, if you go to page 4 and you look at Lake County, you know, they're comparable to Wallowa County with 7,450. But I understood from this data in this document that the cost of the system was also to be included. And so I'm curious, you know, of the cost of the system, is that per the number of lines that are needed? And I don't know, what should a unit cost and how many people should it take to handle 7,250 people, I guess I'm trying to find out.
Chair Crummell, Representative Nelson, the cost today for the public safety answering points out in the cities and counties across the state are for people to answer those 911 calls. If we look at the overall telephone tax, and I believe Dave Austin can do a better job than I could, it is a portion of that overall tax that's collected that goes out to the cities and counties. That's what this bill addresses. There is another amount of that total tax collection that covers the cost of those telephone lines, the telephone equipment in those 911 centers used to answer the calls. Those costs are paid on our behalf by the state of Oregon out of that tax before it ever comes to us. Our costs end up being the people that are necessary to answer the phone lines.
But no, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And I'll just ask this one last one. So, but there's nothing in the administrative rules here that specify how many individuals are needed to handle so many calls, nor what category of a unit should be necessary to efficiently and most effectively and economically provide a 911 service. Is that correct?
Representative Crummell, Chair Crummell, Representative Nelson, there is, I believe, either in statute or administrative rule, a requirement that each public safety answering point have two answering point stations, staffing for one. So there is a requirement that if you're going to run a 911 center, you have to have at least a minimum of one person there by law, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
And then each county, I'm sure, Mr. Chair, you think can determine if they think, you know, what the proportion of 10,000 to 1 staff or 5,000 calls to one or 10,000 residents to one is adequate. I wonder what that number is.
That's a good question. I have just one question, and we really need to move on. But my one question is, how did the changes occur with to the formula without legislation when it was originally set out in legislation? Anybody want to take a stab at that one?
Chair Crummell, again, I attempted to try and dig that information out. It occurred a long time ago, and the gentleman that was the first manager for Office of Emergency Management overseeing the 911 program indicated to me that he couldn't recall. I have probably some speculations, but that's all they are, and I wouldn't really care to express them.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let me have Paul Snyder, Gene Cowan, and Sally Jones come on up. And Hasina, do you want to? Well, there's really only three chairs, so I'll call you up in the next round, okay? And why don't we just go ahead and go in the order in which I called you. So, Paul, if you want to start, that'd be terrific.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, and we're appearing this morning in opposition to House Bill 2913. Mr. Chair, I have an old furnace in my house, and it's really basic, but you can kind of see how it works because it's so simple. It's not very efficient, but it works. And the testimony that we heard earlier this morning kind of reminded me of that furnace. The 911 system started out really basic in 1981. The purpose was to provide the fundamental basic service across the state and then to impose an excise tax that's reasonably calculated to cover those costs. And back then I remember conversing with the primary lobbyist who's trying to get this measure passed in 1981, he had a list, and his list said, these are our calculations that show me what the minimum per county costs are going to be. And it turns out that the rural counties incur the greatest cost because of the distance from one place to another, and there were line charges that were somewhat reflective of distance rather than population. So the actual costs were kind of just the opposite of what you would think of the population center. And he had this list, and his list indicated this is what we think are going to be the minimum per county costs, and so let's set the minimum per county distribution based on what we think are the minimum per county costs. And that was 1981, and so the bill passed in that form. I don't know what the reasons were for the changes in 1987 or going to 0.6% or 1%, but I think there's a good chance that the distribution per county went up as the other purposes were created, like creating the enhanced account that reduced the total amount of money that actually flowed individually to counties. But it also created a fund with which enhanced 911 could be created across the state. So maybe that had something to do with it. But the reason for our opposition to House Bill 2913 has to do simply with the notion that although this system has evolved over a long period of time, and a lot of things have changed. I mean, in 1981, nobody even heard the word cell phone before. Didn't know what they were. But a lot of things have changed since then, and the cost of providing the service has changed. Still, nonetheless, you still need a basic minimum amount of money in order to do the job. And you going to a population-based formula does not seem to take into account what the actual costs are of delivering the service. It might be more reflective, they might not. But our recommendation to the committee would be, rather than going with House Bill 2913, or even going with the red line, because that's also arbitrary, it just has less of an impact on current costs, would be to endorse the APCO-NENA approach that I believe was undertaken in December of last year, to say, let's take a look statewide for what the actual costs are of delivering the service so that we can assure the people of Oregon, no matter where they are or where they're going, that they're going to be able to access a 911 operator when they make a call from wherever it is that they are, whether it's by landline or a cell phone or something else. And I think those costs are not reflected in a population-based form. So for those reasons, we would recommend that the committee, rather than approving the House Bill 2914 approach, instead approve the review of the actual costs. And as testimony has kind of indicated, even among the proponents this morning, there are some places in the state, Wheeler, Gillum, and Sherman counties, Polk County, the redistribution of the funds is going to result in an increase for some counties, but a decrease for most counties, and some counties are not going to be able to cover the actual cost of operating the piece. And I don't think that's an outcome anybody wants.
Okay. You done?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and just move right to Jean Cowan and
Chair Cremel, members of the committee. My name is Jean Cowan. I'm a Lincoln County Commissioner, and I'm also here representing AOC. I also have a longstanding passion for preserving the quality of 911 service in Oregon through the various funding distributions that have recognized that the citizens of Oregon and our visitors deserve the same level of service no matter where you might be when an emergency occurs. And I focus on that a bit. Paul and I have both been around since this started in 1981. At the time, Paul was on the policy development involved over here, and I was in a small rural Oregon community in eastern Oregon, one of those little communities that you pass through if you're going somewhere else, and struggling with developing this kind of a service and, frankly, getting people to accept the change from the old answer the phone at the motel and see if you could find somebody that could respond. I'm proud of the system that we've developed, and I think that it's really important that we maintain it. And I know that some of these formulas are old, that they were based partially on some of the extraordinary costs of developing those early systems in our more rural communities. So I certainly recognize the need to review the formulas and to take a look at what the actual costs are, as Paul articulated. And I think that the APCO-NINA approach, I apologize for that acronym, I'm not sure that I can say all the words that go with that, but I'm sure one of the organization folks can tell you what they mean. They've agreed to undertake this review of a funding formula over the next biennium and offer some recommendations, and I would support that discussion. But House Bill 2913 is not the answer. For Lincoln County, we fall sort of in the middle of the population-based calculations, and our loss is significant, not as significant as others. You will be provided with written testimony from the director of our local PSAP, that can articulate better than I the specific costs, although I do serve on that governing board and I'm familiar with our operations. But my concern really is for the whole system. The inequities in this bill are what move the Association of Oregon Counties, or AOC, to a position of opposition for this bill. It's simply not acceptable to propose a short-sighted redistribution under which some counties stand to enjoy significant gain while there's an unacceptable cost to 25 of the smaller counties, especially without the red line provision or a hold harmless provision. This is a particularly arbitrary proposal and potentially devastating to service delivery in these harsh economic times when we're simply not able to make up that significant a loss at the local level. In addition, House Bill 2913 is in fact particularly problematic to the three very small counties that you've heard mentioned here several times today who do not yet have their own PSAP. And that's the reason that there has been some funds building up, and you've heard the 300% and some of those numbers, which taken on the surface are concerning. But those same folks have been working diligently to develop a PSAP, and it's scheduled to open April 1st. So they've been through all the hoops, and suddenly some of this funding is being changed dramatically in the way that they've been for what they've been planning for. there has to be a better way to approach the distribution formula question and to preserve the present high quality of 911 service throughout Oregon. I was making a few notes to myself, and I just want to mention that population alone, or even call volume, isn't an adequate guideline of the total expense of a program, because it does take a certain amount of funds to provide a basic level of service. For example, in Lincoln County, our population base is 40,000 plus, but we serve probably 3 to 4 times that many folks on any given weekend. So if you base things on the population alone, it doesn't totally address the workload. Similarly, the really small counties, if you had or your family members happen to be the ones that are traveling through when you have an emergency, you want there to be someone giving you the same quality of service when you pick up the phone and dial 911 as if you lived in a metropolitan area. And that's always a challenge for the rural populations. So I would urge you today to reject House Bill 2913 and to charge the APCO-NENA organization to work with the Oregon Emergency Management, the sheriffs and police chiefs to find an equitable solution to this challenging problem. And I appreciate your attention today.
Okay. Thank you. Go right ahead.
Chair Crumbel, members of the committee, I am Sally Jones. I'm the administrator of the Columbia 911 Communications District. Our district is the single 911 call-taking center and dispatch center for the 17 public safety agencies in Columbia County. We were formed by the voters in Columbia County in 1989. I'm also vice president of Oregon APCO-NENA. And incidentally, those letters stand for the Associated Public Communications Officials International and the National Emergency Number Association. In Oregon, we have merged those two professional groups into a single group. I'm also a trustee on the Special Districts of Oregon Insurance Services Trust. I have served in emergency communications since 1973 and since 1978 in Oregon. I'm testifying today on behalf of my district on House Bill 2913, which proposes to change the 1% minimum distribution formula for 911 excise tax funds. I oppose House Bill 2913 unless it is amended to include a red line feature to mitigate the impact on small and medium-sized 911 jurisdictions. I was very pleased to hear the testimony from AOC and from the Lincoln County Commissioner suggesting that APCO-NENA be charged with studying this issue over the next biennium. That is something that our association does intend to do, regardless of the impact, regardless of what happens with House Bill 2913. We have committed to do that, recognizing that the 911 excise tax funds distribution formula does need to be updated. I think it's important to remember that the 911 excise tax, which is collected by the phone companies and turned over to the state, does now pay for the emergency call reporting equipment. It pays for the telecommunicator and emergency medical dispatcher certification program and for the enhanced 911 technology. Then what is left over is distributed back to the cities and the counties for their public safety answering point and dispatching costs. The current distribution formula, as you have heard, incorporates a minimum distribution to counties who fall below a certain total state population in their unincorporated area. The purpose for that minimum distribution, when it was established, is to assure that a caller in a 911 area in Lake County will get the same level of basic 911 service or enhanced 911 service as a caller would in downtown Beaverton. For many 911 centers, this revenue represents 15 to 20% of their operating revenue. For the smaller 911 centers, it's a much greater percentage. The remainder of the costs to take the call and dispatch the call is paid for by local communities. The formula as it is currently applied has had some unintended problems. The Sherman-Gilliam-Wheeler County example is one of them. They have received more in excise taxes than they pay out in user fees to Malheur County, although they do have a plan for those funds, if you, as you have heard. The other 911 center, I want to emphasize that that is not typical. The Sherman-Gilliam-Wheeler County example is not typical of the counties in this state. For most of us, that funding stream is critical to run our operations. It represents a minimum of 15 to 20% of our revenue, if not more. And we use it all up. Every year it doesn't get saved for most of the centers. Another problem is the inequity between counties of similar population, that it would seem that they should each receive a similar amount. And in fact, they do seem to get a similar amount, but there is a discrepancy between, for example, Klamath County and Coos County. Coos County right now gets more funds than Klamath County because Klamath County has too many people in their unincorporated area and therefore does not qualify for the minimum distribution. Coos County does. They have a lower population in their unincorporated area. Both of those counties do get the regular distribution to their cities. And then another example is that Multnomah County, ironically, does qualify for the unincorporated distribution because they have a low population in their unincorporated area. Most of their population is in their city. So there are some unintended impacts of this formula. But and we agree that the formula should be looked at. As I've said, our group has committed to study what changes should be made to that formula over the next biennium. Now, House Bill 2913 just makes a flat change in the formula so that it would apply only to total county population. There's no difference between unincorporated or not. It applies to total county population. And under that, the example of Klamath County, that inequity would be solved. If Klamath County would certainly get more than Coos County under that formula, but Multnomah County would also get quite a bit more than they do under the current formula, as would all of the larger counties. In my written testimony, I talk about Oregon Outconina, the fact that we did form a committee last year that did have representation of small, medium, large PSAPs on it. And the general membership of the 911 managers agreed that if this bill was introduced, that we would respond with the fact that we're fully aware that this is a divisive issue. We're fully aware that the formula needs to be looked at. And if this formula, as proposed by 2913, would be proposed, that we would urge that a red line feature would be included in that if it went forward. Now, the red line feature is not a hold harmless. That's really not an accurate phrase to define it. Red line simply would freeze what those smaller counties are getting now in the current biennium. It would freeze it so that they would continue to get the same amount into the next biennium and beyond until the fund actually grew to the point where their red line freeze could be lifted and they would receive more funds. So it is not a hold harmless provision. If the fund grows, and it grows in proportion to the number of increased people take out phone lines or cell phones, then those counties under the red line would not enjoy the increase in that fund until the fund grew enough that they would come out of their distribution freeze. House Bill 2913 does not include this red line feature at all. It just changes the formula to apply to total county population. I've attached a spreadsheet to my written testimony that identifies, I put some notes, handwritten notes at the top. I apologize. I hope you can read my writing. But it does list the difference of what's expected to be collected next biennium with no change in the formula what would be distributed under House Bill 2913 and the impact of that and what the difference would be to each of those counties. Also added on that under column E is if the formula is changed but the red line feature is incorporated, then under the last column that shows the difference. And you can see there's still a loss under the red line feature, but it is not as harsh as just the straight formula change. Even though there is a loss, because of our knowledge that the formula does need to be looked at under the current use and under what our actual costs are in these times right now, the 911 managers were willing to support that change as long as the red line feature was there to help us mitigate that impact. If 2913 is passed as drafted, it significantly increases the distribution amounts to the 11 largest counties. I know that this bill or testimony has been said that this bill is not about taking from one and giving to the other, but the reality is there's a finite amount of money, and if you're going to distribute more money to some, others are going to get less. Under this formula, the 11 counties that get more happened also to be the 11 largest counties. The 25 that get less are the smallest ones. And for some, this will threaten their ability to be able to provide that seamless level of service that we have all wanted to have and we desire to have as individuals. Though it is true that population and activity has some correlation to the cost to deliver this service, that per capita use is in direct proportion to a decrease in total population. Smaller and rural areas do not enjoy the economy of scale that the larger cities and larger counties enjoy. We just don't. We can't. The formulas have recognized that fact in the past, and the current formula recognizes that. The proposed formula would still recognize that, but not to the extent, in my opinion, that is sufficient for the very small agencies to be able to continue, or at least they would have to change their level of service. At the very least, they'd have to turn to other agencies and raise their fees for service, other police and fire departments in their area. Oregon Apcomina has tried to foster a consensus approach to this issue. It has been the most divisive issue that we have ever faced as an organization. Our desire is to continue to seek a viable solution by working on identifying an updated formula to reflect current use and the needs for these funds, and not lose sight of our goal of seamless 911 service statewide. In summary, as a longstanding member and the current vice president of Oregon Apcomina, I oppose House Bill 2913 as written unless it is amended to include the red line feature. As the administrator of Columbia 911 Communications District, I urge the committee to carefully consider the potential impact of House Bill 2913 on rural, small, and medium-sized 911 dispatch jurisdictions and our desire to maintain a seamless 911 service statewide. I testify today not to just defend my district's revenue. We kind of fall in the middle. It would certainly have an impact. But I'm testifying today because of my concern about the larger picture. I thank you for the opportunity to express my concerns and suggest mitigation. I'd be happy to clarify my testimony and answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. I would like to just ask you the same question that I asked the last panel, and that is the changes that occurred, and they evidently occurred without legislation. Any idea how that occurred?
I don't recall, Chairman Kremel, members of the committee, I don't recall that those changes occurred without legislation. I know in the early years that there was the legislation was different in that the formula for distribution, I believe, was established by administrative rule instead of being in the statute, but I could be wrong about that recollection. I know that the changes that have been made since were through legislative process.
Okay. And then one other question, and that is the comment about the plan for funds when counties were getting more than what it was actually costing them to provide the service. When in what appears to be House Bill 3977 from the 01 session was passed, and it basically called for in that in section one of that bill for consolidation to be occurring, why would smaller counties have been looking at building their own centers? Any idea?
Try to go for that one.
Chair Kremel. I think that many of us who have more than one primary safety answering point or PSAP within our counties,
right,
have sought consolidation, sometimes more successfully than others. But in this particular instance, you're talking about three separate counties who have no PSAP, as I understand it, at this point, and desire to have some level of service. You're talking about a lot of distance when you put together some of these rural counties, and I think it's reasonable for people in their communities to expect that they would build towards having some level of a public safety answering point within that combined jurisdiction. But I'm not totally familiar with their situation. I just spoke with one of the commissioners from one of those counties last week, and she had indicated to me that after a great deal of hard work and development and working through the regulatory process with Oregon Emergency Management and trying to meet all the qualifications, they were ready to open a center on April 1st and are pretty devastated by this particular legislation.
Okay. Any other questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. We'll have, can we have Hasina and Mary come up at the same time, or do you guys want to need to, you know, like, duke it out?
We'll appear together.
You would? Okay. Hasina Squires and Mary Bodkin, come on up.
Because, you know, when we're doing hers, we have to successfully.
Well, I know, and I just want to make sure that, you know, this is one of those issues that it's, but I see that you still have brought your, you know, some protection in between the two.
Yes, we have mediator.
Hasina, why don't you go ahead and start?
Thank you, Chair Kremel, members of the committee. For the record today, my name is Hasina Squires. I'm here today on behalf of the APCO NENA Oregon chapters. And since Sally Jones has already explained to you what that acronym is, I'm just thankful not to be in front of Representative Butler's committee, where I would have just had to have paid $2 for the two acronyms.
I was thinking we are Jackie Winters.
Oh, yes.
Here, I have a cup.
I have no change. Thanks. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with me today is Lynn Reeves, who within our association, the APCO NENA Association, was the chair during the interim of the task force committee formed to deal with this, what we term the 1% issue. That's really not an accurate statement, but to deal with this entire issue within our own membership, our association did form an ad hoc committee. Anyone that was interested, that wanted to participate in the committee, was notified and had the opportunity to participate in that committee. Held several meetings. Since I was not in attendance in any of those meetings, Ms. Reeves is here with me today and has all of the knowledge of all of the discussion that took place during those committees. But what's being handed out to you is, in fact, the APCO NENA position on this issue. And I just want to. I have several things that I want to express to this committee. Some of them deal with this issue and some of them don't. Some of them deal more globally with 911. But I do want to point out to you that our committee, our association, did take the lead, knowing that Klamath Falls 911 was going to introduce a bill that did not contain a red line formula. Our group proactively sought to communicate amongst its membership and determine where we could reach common ground. And what you have before you is what we have been able to develop as common ground, and that common ground ended up being that, yes, it is a divisive issue the way the current funding distribution with the unincorporated population of the 1% is distributed. We recognize that. However, a more appropriate approach to take in evaluating the issue would be to determine, in fact, what is the cost for statewide 911 service? What are the costs associated with doing business in the state of Oregon? Is it different in Gilliam County? Is it different in Washington County? What's the call volume? There are so many different factors that could be taken into consideration, and we really felt that a preferable approach would be to take a look at what are we doing? What is the cost? There are a number of components of the 911 system that have not been completed yet. As many of you may know, Phase 2 wireless is not completed in the state of Oregon. There are additional costs that local agencies in the state will be incurring related to the 911 reporting system. So our group coalesced around a proposal in response to legislation we knew would be coming forth from one of our members that did not contain a red line clause in it. That is basically the position to have a complete evaluation of the cost of maintaining seamless and reliable 911 service delivery in the state of Oregon, and that evaluation should be undertaken, and it should be performed in conjunction with the 2008 sunset that currently exists for the 911 tax. This legislative body will be considering in 2007 the 75-cent per line charge sunset in 2007, and we hope to be able to bring back something within our group to determine what is the cost of maintaining seamless 911 in the state of Oregon. In the absence of a bill that contains a red line formula, and I just want to note for the record that no association here you will not see an association appear before you supporting this legislation. You will see individual agencies. You will not see the Sheriff's Association. You won't see AOC. You won't see League of Cities. You won't see APCO-NENA coming and supporting a bill that contains no red line provision in it. In the absence of a red line provision, and if the legislature so chooses to take this issue up during this legislative session and address the issue of the unincorporated population calculation of the distribution, our association will oppose any legislation that does not contain a red line provision in it. That's our position. I would like to just respond to a few things that I've heard over the last couple of hours on this issue. This bill, first of all, if I could just direct your attention to page 2, lines 41 through 42, the language in the bill states very clearly that this change pertains to counties that contain the minimum 1% or the minimum funding distribution would be to counties that contain a primary public safety answering point. Currently, Gilliam, Sherman, Wheeler, and Polk counties do not contain a PSAP. So this effectively does eliminate that distribution to those three counties, the minimum, because they do not contain a PSAP. So there are four counties. Representative Mabry, you had asked a question about the $1,800 to Wheeler County and the dedicated phone line. I just want to point out for the record that cost would be picked up by the state of Oregon. It's currently a cost that is paid for by the state of Oregon. It's not part of the city-county distribution, just to clear that up.
Thank you.
Also, I'd just like to bring up a few other issues with respect to 911. As many of you may know, and Representative Crummell, you're very familiar with House Bill 3977 from last legislative session. That legislation did not require consolidation of 911 PSAPs. What it did was it required any county that contained more than one primary public safety answering point to submit a consolidation plan to the Office of Emergency Management. And in the event that each of the jurisdictions within the county did not agree upon a consolidation plan, then the Office of Emergency Management was directed by this legislative body to, in fact, write that plan for consolidation. Within the confines of House Bill 3977 from last legislative session, the Ways and Means process changed the fund of the 911 tax from a non-limited fund to a limited fund, so we now are required to seek expenditure limitation authority. And in House Bill 3977 from last legislative session, we were essentially, our expenditure limitation authority was capped at $56 million. The excess amount of money that was generated in revenue, not excess as in surplus, but as in any dollars that came in above $56 million, went into what was called the PFAP Consolidation Incentive Fund. And as your committee administrator knows and the chair knows, there are several bills dealing with that this legislative session. During the third legislative special session, actually first, second, and third, and successfully in the third special legislative sessions, all of that money that was generated and distributed into the 911 PSAP Consolidation Incentive Fund was redirected to the state's general fund.
That's putting it kindly.
Redirected. I like the word redirect. Was redirected. And in addition to that, sorry, I have to count on my fingers, $2 million. $2 or $3 million.
Huh? Yeah, a million here, a million there.
A couple million bucks, Mr. Chair. Actually, it was $2 million, was also taken from the enhanced 911 subaccount and redirected to the state's general fund. And the main point that I want to bring up about this issue is that we are currently down in the Ways and Means process with Oregon State Police's budget last week and this week. We will be arguing for full expenditure limitation authority of $64 million, which is what is in the governor's budget, no funding of the PSAP Consolidation Incentive Fund, and getting that money back out to the locals. This whole issue is really moot without the $64 million expenditure limitation authority. If you don't authorize the money, really doesn't matter who gets it, because there's no money to give.
Because nobody gets it.
Correct. I'd also just like to follow up on Chief Johnson's statement regarding the applicable science. We think that there is an applicable science that could be used, and it's just not been fully evaluated. And that would be back to our original position. What is the cost of maintaining a seamless 911 service in the state of Oregon? And that is, in fact, what our position is. With that, if you have any questions with respect to where our committee deliberations or any of that process, Ms. Reeves is perfectly capable of answering those questions, as I'm not able to.
Thank you. Ms. Reeves, did you have a statement you wanted to make? Or?
I do. Thank you, Chair. Chair Crummell, members of the committee, I am Lynn Reeves. I'm the Director of Central Lane Communications in Eugene. I've been asked to speak about the plan approved by Oregon APCO NENA that addresses the 1% issue. The 1% minimum issue was raised at an early 2002 quarterly meeting of our organization. In response, the executive board appointed a committee to develop a plan to address the 1%. The committee was made up of representatives from small, medium, large, rural, coastal, and metro 911 agencies. We met on over 5 occasions. Each time we discussed different options for tax distribution. As an example, we spent considerable time looking at applying a different percentage. We deemed the disparities of percentage changes to be too great. We settled, if you will, on applying the 1% to total county population. Recognizing that there would be counties whose total distribution would decline, we agreed upon a red line plan of implementation. As an example, I use Lake County. Applying 1% to total Lake County population, they would receive a quarterly distribution of $49,500. They would be limited or redlined to that amount until total statewide tax distribution exceeds $4,956,000. This plan was presented for discussion at the October Oregon APCO quarterly meeting. The plan was then approved at the December meeting. That's it, basically. It was a pretty simple process.
Okay. Thank you. Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Bodkin, and I'm here today representing Abstinence Council 75. You know, we didn't sign up for or against, and I'm not going to.
I know you didn't.
For or against at this point, because we have the honor of representing many 911 operators. They don't make all these lofty decisions. They only answer the phones. So having said that, you know, I'm not going to pick one group over another group and say they ought to get more money than this group. But instead, what I want to do is, you know, Gary Wilhelm and I in 1981 worked together to get this passed. And, you know, that was back in the good old days when everybody used to work together because nobody had any money. And I told Messina earlier that I was trying to figure out if we'd be better off if we just repealed the whole thing and took all the money away so these folks could learn how it felt to work together to find funding to pay for 911. And that's what it was all about back then. It was about professionalizing the service, about making sure that every child in Oregon could pick up the phone and call for help. You know, and then we figured out we had enhanced 911. You know, and we thought it made sense to increase the income a bit and make sure that everybody in Oregon could get help, whether or not they could verbalize their address or not, so that a dispatcher and a call taker could get emergency services to anybody. Then, you know, a couple of sessions ago, we decided to do it with cell phones. What a concept. When do you need 911 if you're in your car? Oh, I don't know, when you've been in an accident, you know? You may not be able to tell people where you are. We needed to keep expanding and professionalizing this. You know, we worked with a lot of our 911 professionals to make sure that every operator, every call taker in Oregon went through a standardized training program through DPSSD. Representative Krasanski helped us with that bill. You know, those are things that we were supposed to be looking at. And I feel like I'm caught in some kind of a weird dimension here where we're going to fight over the money that we have instead of going back and, as Messina said, go back and say, what does it cost? You know, enhanced equipment for Wheeler County doesn't cost any less than enhanced equipment for Multnomah. But the reality is, you get more money out of Multnomah than you do out of Wheeler. So should we change the distribution? Maybe. But do we make sure that everybody in Oregon is being adequately served first? Yeah, I think we do. And if that means that we, you know, just kind of take a breath and take a step back and not fight over the pot, but rather make sure that everything is adequately funded, identify how much it really costs, and then from that point forward, figure out how you distribute the funds to cover as much of the cost as we can. And, you know, I wish I had this problem in corrections or in the state police budget where I had money that I didn't know how to spend and I wanted to, like, take it from somebody else, because it just feels to me like that county's trying to cannibalize each other over 911 funds, and I really don't want that to happen. What I want to have happen is for us to remember why we're here. We're here so that every two-year-old can pick up a phone and get help. Period. That's why we're here. That every elderly person can pick up a phone and get help, regardless of where they live. And the second part is, how do we pay for it? And this was a way to pay for it. And can we just kind of go back and say, you know, if, I mean, I don't know why Sherman County or Wheeler County has all this money. I don't know why all these people have this money. I don't know why. But I'm not willing to take it away from them until we figure it out. And do they need a PSAP? If they need a PSAP, then let's get on the ball and get them one. If they don't need one, let's figure out what we need to do to properly fund the call takers and the services that are giving them the services that they need. And if we need more money in Multnomah County, fine. But let's not lose sight of the fact that we want everybody to have the same access to the same services regardless of their geographic location. And my folks just want to answer the phone. That's all they want to do.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair, is this the last witness?
Unless somebody else decides that they want to come up and speak. Okay.
Oh, excuse me.
What? Go ahead. What?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I'm assuming. But this change to this previous bill was done by this committee that has a broad base of co-sponsors. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that committee has a financial synopsis of how they worked you know, how they got to this point to prepare this amendment. Would we know if that was possible to get a copy of what they based it on?
Of what? I'm not sure I'm following your question.
Well, the point is that there's a cost here, like we've just been talking about. That was my first question earlier to the gentleman. Right. And I just wondered, to get this amendment drafted, did somebody have a cost study done through which they then made this amendment, that felt each county line 41 on should get a certain percentage?
That I don't know if that was the case or not.
It's apparent we need a financial analysis.
Probably wouldn't hurt to have a financial analysis on this, and I don't think at this point we do have.
Mr. Chair, I spoke to Legislative Fiscal this morning, and they indicated that the bill will have a significant effect on budgeting, and so there will be a fiscal statement issued, but they also indicated that they would prefer that the bill come to the way go to the Ways and Means Committee after it leaves our committee. That's the desire of the committee, and so so I can speak to them about getting a fiscal analysis done prior to that if the committee desires to.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I'm hoping that we'll get some data per cost of unit, per number of individuals who could respond in season and, you know, out of season, take care of our tourist, destinations as well as our rural that have, you know, few visitors but a lot of fishermen and a broader distance versus the urban areas. I mean, I think we need that kind of study to show what cost to adequately cover 3.5 million Oregonians plus hopefully a 4 million tourists this year. It'll bring us some money.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Committee, just to give you a little bit of a heads up on where I think we should go with this is while I appreciate the work of APCO Nina from a standpoint of wanting to figure out what the cost is, I guess sort of having known that this was coming, it would have been nice if they would have already have completed that work. I'm not real interested in getting into a grudge match between one county versus another, and I do understand from the standpoint of what it costs, and if there's for example, if it costs Wheeler County X number of dollars to provide the service so that everybody in Wheeler County has got the access that they need, then we should be covering that on the same kind of proportional basis that we cover it in, whether it's Washington or Multnomah or any other county. What I'm most disturbed by is the audit report from the Secretary of State's office, and I would just call your attention to that, members, and some of the things that they found with regards to unauthorized expenditures and some of those things. And what I'm probably more interested in doing is figuring out what those unauthorized expenditures are, how we prevent those in the future, and then making sure that the cost of services is covered in as much as this tax is going to cover the cost of service. I did not agree with our actions in the special sessions when we took dollars out of the fund. Although when those budget bills did come to the floor, I did vote for the budget bills. Because I did not have the option of picking them apart as a member. I guess what I'm more interested in doing, we're not going to take this bill into work session today because we don't have anything to take into work session because of the way the bill is, I believe has a constitutional problem. But I think that what we do need to do is work on figuring out how we address the issues brought out in the Secretary of State's report. And so what I would like to have happen is I would like for, and since APCO Nina seems to sort of be kind of the convening organization here, and Washington County, Clackamas County, Klamath County, the larger counties that would be, I guess, benefiting from an increased dollar amount from this. I think maybe what I would like to see is if APCO Nino would go back to your members, and I guess also includes Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, to visit with them about what are some realistic amendments that can be brought forward to this bill that would prevent the unauthorized expenditures from occurring, that will make sure that the services being provided statewide, which has always been the goal, and that if in fact the smaller counties such as Wheeler, Sherman, and Gilliam need to have a call center in each of their counties, then fine, let's figure out what it's going to take to get it there. If they don't, if they can more cost effectively provide that service by contracting with another service and how that can work, then that's fine too. But I think the overall broad goal here should be what we're going to do to make sure that the service is provided in a cost effective manner and that the recommendations from the audit report can be addressed. So I would like to ask APCO Nina to kind of go back and do that, and maybe you could just get in touch with me sometime in the next couple of weeks and let me know how that process is going.
And Mr. Chair,
I would appreciate that. Representative Nelson.
Would it be possible also from a public safety viewpoint to find out what Homeland Security is funding and these systems as well as our new state program?
Absolutely.
Would that be okay?
Yes, and I think that should be something that we need to look at. Is how this can work into, and because this all falls under the Office of Emergency Management, I think that's kind of a natural segue into that. Representative Mabry?
May I just say, Mr. Chairman, that representing these three counties that are mentioned very, very frequently, the Sherman, Gilliam, and Wheeler counties, the audit report is just that. It's an audit report that has not been adjudicated by any means, and probably won't be. But supposedly there were six counties picked at random, and it just happens that three of those six are Sherman, Gilliam, Wheeler County that combined their resources to put together something. I suspect those weren't really random. I suspect they were targeted. And I suspect part of the reason they were targeted is because they had been accumulating funds to build their system. And I can tell you for a fact that those people felt like they were using those funds appropriately and still feel like they were using those funds appropriately. And just because it says in an audit report that somebody doesn't agree with that doesn't mean it's not true. We still have the ability to challenge those things, and rightfully so. So I agree with everything you said, and I will adamantly defend my three county governing bodies for the work they took, because I think they were trying to serve their constituents the only way they had available to do that, and they do deserve someone to answer the phone when somebody's in trouble and calls 911. So,
absolutely, I would agree with you, and I think that's the overall goal here, is to make sure that there is someone there to answer the phone. Any other comments, questions? With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2913. Thank you. And since we don't have anything else, and we're out of time, we'll stand adjourned. Thank you.